From Feature Story News in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Kevin McAleese. On today's programme, a challenge to abortion clinic buffer zones goes to the US Supreme Court.
This is America, thank God. And we have First Amendment right, which means gently speaking to someone, offering hope, help, and love. I should be able to do that.
California's record-breaking drought threatens a nationwide food shortage. We're in London to discover why so-called smart homes could reduce the global carbon footprint. And we find out exactly what life is like for the 1.4 million Americans hit by the Senate's failure to extend unemployment benefits.
How dare you call me lazy? You don't know who I am. And I've sent out over 2,000 resumes and have been rejected over and over again.
That's coming up on FSN Reports after our latest summary of the day's headlines.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Rebecca Foster. President Obama is reportedly preparing to place some restraints on the use of electronic surveillance by U.S. government agencies. He's due to unveil his proposals in a speech at the U.S. Justice Department in Washington on Friday. Simon Marks reports.
The president's speech is much anticipated and comes after months of revelations by fugitive whistleblower Edward Snowden. For weeks, Mr. Obama has said he wants to strike a new balance between privacy and national security. Newspaper reports indicate he'll place limits on access to telephone records that are being collected in bulk by the government, call for privacy safeguards for non-US citizens, including leaders of foreign nations, and appoint a public advocate to represent privacy concerns at hearings of a secret intelligence court. A presidential review panel wanted him to go much further, but the White House seems poised to balance the outrage of civil libertarians against the desires of America's national security establishment.
Meanwhile, news broke that the U.S. National Security Agency has implanted software on nearly 100,000 computers worldwide, allowing them to spy on those machines. That's according to a report in the New York Times. The newspaper quoted NSA documents, computer experts, and U.S. officials to back up its claims, saying that the secret technology uses radio waves to gain access to computers that other countries have tried to protect from spying or cyber attacks. It says the same software could also be used to create a digital highway for launching cyber attacks. Western and Gulf Arab states have offered $1.4 billion to support United Nations aid efforts in the war-torn nation of Syria. The pledge comes in response to an appeal for $6.5 billion from UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon, the largest in UN history. From New York, Iris Spitzer has more.
United Nations aid efforts in Syria received a boost at a donors' conference in Kuwait, with Western and Gulf states promising $2.4 billion in relief money. The largest donations will come from Kuwait, who promised $500 million, and the United States, who announced a contribution of $380 million. Last month, United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon said that $6.5 billion was needed to provide medical care, food, water, and shelter to Syrian refugees and civilians who have suffered under a devastating civil war that has lasted almost 3 years. Ban also said that he hoped that the peace talks set to begin in Switzerland on January 22nd will bring the Syrian government and opposition leaders to the negotiating table.
Israel's defense minister has apologized for calling U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry obsessive and messianic. The U.S. State Department had expressed its surprise and anger that Israel would say such a thing in regard to John Kerry's quest for Middle East peace. From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. Russian lawmakers are proposing a new bill tightening security and control in many spheres, including the internet, online payments, and information exchange on the web. It would also give the country's security services the right to stop and search vehicles and individuals suspected of terrorism. Here's Daria Bondarchuk from Moscow.
Several bills are proposed under wider umbrella anti-terrorism law, increasing punishment for terrorism-related activities. One package controlling money transfers may put under government control all individual online transfers over $30,000 with an obligatory ID check for both senders and recipients of online payments. Another bill would oblige companies and individuals posting information or involved in data exchange online to store all logs for 6 months and allow the security services to access them if requested. That, critics of the law warn, would include mass media and social networks, email exchange services, data hosting and file sharing storages. The third package would allow Russia's Federal Security Service to stop anyone suspected of involvement in terrorism and check their vehicles and belongings. Human rights activists have slammed the legislators' initiative as an attempt to introduce total surveillance and control over the society.
And the level of piracy at sea has dropped to its lowest level in 6 years, showing a 40% drop since the height of piracy in Somalia in 2011. Dan Whitehead reports from London.
According to the International Maritime Bureau, the single biggest reason for the drop in worldwide piracy is the decrease in Somali piracy off the coast of East Africa. There were only 15 incidents off Somalia last year. That's compared to 237 back in 2011. The IMB's annual Global Piracy Report says more than 300 people were taken hostage at sea in 2013 and 21 were injured, mostly with knives or guns. Indonesia saw the most attacks, accounting for more than 50% of all incidents.
And that's the latest Feature Story News. Rebecca Foster reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kevin McAleese. Welcome to FSN Reports. It was abortion rights versus the First Amendment at the US Supreme Court today, as the justices weighed whether a law in Massachusetts that puts a buffer zone around health clinics properly protects patients and workers or infringes on the free speech rights of those trying to talk women out of terminating a pregnancy. The landmark case was heard at the same time lawmakers in Congress pushed forward a bill that would make it more difficult for low-income women to use public or private health insurance to pay for an abortion. On Capitol Hill, our correspondent Alice Olstein has the story.
76-year-old grandmother Eleanor McCullen has spent 13 years doing what she calls sidewalk counseling, approaching women who are headed into one of Massachusetts' health clinics that perform abortions. She claims she's convinced nearly 100 women not to go through with the procedure, but says she would be able to do more were she not ordered by state law to stay at least 35 feet away from the doorway.
With the buffer zone, I get so far and they're listening, I have to stop. And then they keep going and I lose. I'm impeded from my message of love and my message of help.
McCullen and her fellow demonstrators brought their case all the way to the Supreme Court, saying the buffer zone law is unconstitutional because it discriminates against their anti-abortion message, but allows clinic workers and volunteers who support abortion rights to accompany patients inside the zone. Their legal team told the justices Wednesday that the law creates a, quote, distortion of the marketplace of ideas and unfairly criminalizes peaceful, consensual conversation.
This is America, thank God. And we have First Amendment right, which means gently speaking to someone, offering hope, help, and love. I should be able to do that.
But representatives of the state of Massachusetts, the federal government, and the clinics themselves argued the law strikes a constitutional balance between allowing demonstrators ample opportunity to express themselves and protecting the safety of patients and staff. They cited a record of violence at abortion clinics in the state, including 2 murders in the mid-90s and dozens of documented cases of harassment and intimidation since then. Marty Walls with Planned Parenthood of Massachusetts, which operates 3 of the clinics in question, told reporters what it was like before the buffer zone was instituted in 2007.
There were large groups of people standing shoulder to shoulder in our doorway, usually screaming at full volume, not quiet counseling, trying to prevent our patients and staff from coming into the health center to come to work or to obtain health care.
But several justices wondered during Wednesday's arguments whether the law was too broad, criminalizing lawful speech along with threatening speech and behavior. Justice Antonin Scalia asked why existing federal laws that ban people from harassing patients and physically blocking entrances weren't enough. When Massachusetts argued that it was too difficult under those laws to prosecute someone because you have to prove intent, Justice Anthony Kennedy scoffed, "Even a dog knows when it's stumbled over and when it's kicked." But Walls and others who experienced life both before and after the buffer zone was put in place said the law has made a difference in putting an end to decades of fear and violence outside the clinics.
It's the only thing that's ever worked to keep access free and clear so that women can obtain health care without having to run a gauntlet of screaming, angry, intimidating people. No woman should have to do that simply to see her doctor.
Some justices and lawyers also spent a good deal of time Wednesday debating just how far 35 feet is. Some said it was the length of two cars, while others compared it to the distance of an NBA three-pointer. McCullen's head lawyer conceded that it takes just about 7 seconds to walk across that distance. But Salem, Massachusetts attorney Philip Marian, who worked on this case at the state level, told reporters that it's far enough to distort his client's message.
If you're 35 feet away, you cannot have an eye-to-eye conversational tone. I defy you to tell me that a woman who's going into an abortion clinic, who's under stress, is going to listen to somebody with a bullhorn. It's going to drive them away.
Because every lower court to look at this law has found it constitutional, the fact that the Supreme Court took up the case at all has abortion rights advocates worried. They said since the justices have supported buffer zones for protests at political conventions and even outside the Supreme Court itself, it would be unfair to outlaw them for abortion clinics. Meanwhile, just across the street, a powerful congressional committee held a markup on the recently introduced No Taxpayer Funding for Abortion Act, a bill that would cut all coverage of abortion care from both the Affordable Care Act's subsidized insurance plans and Medicaid. A group of Democrats, including Texas Representative Sheila Jackson Lee, gathered outside the hearing in protest, saying the bill is part of a draconian agenda advanced by Republicans to restrict a woman's right to choose.
Women love their children. Families love their children. Women want to choose to have children, but they have the right to choose to save their lives and to protect the health of them and their families. We will not stand for the undermining of women's rights under the Constitution of the United States of America.
The bill has little chance of passing the Senate or getting signed by the president. But opponents said it's important to call out every attempt to restrict reproductive rights, especially those that disproportionately target low-income women. In Washington, I'm Alice Olstein.
This is FSN Reports. More than 1 million Americans are facing economic uncertainty after political stalemate in the Senate left them without their unemployment benefits. The state support is a lifeline for more than 1.4 million people who have been out of work for more than 6 months. But last night, a potential agreement to extend the benefits fell apart, and it doesn't look like it'll be resolved anytime soon. It's a bleak outlook for the millions of Americans trying to find a job. Bryce Covert, economic policy editor with Think Progress, has been speaking to FSN's Kate Fisher. She explained why the plans for an extension have stalled.
There was some squabbling over procedural issues, disagreements over how amendments should be offered. It got pretty arcane, but basically Republicans have put up a filibuster in the Senate against it, and Senate Democrats who have been trying to extend the benefits weren't able to overcome it. Now the Senate is not likely to be able to do anything about it before the end of the week, and they're actually off next week as well, which means that they're not likely to be taking any action on this issue the next week and a half or so. The House Democrats are attempting today, actually, to try and bring up a vote on the extension. Of course, even if they were to pass it, it would still need the Senate to take action, so we're not likely to see an extension anytime soon. But it's also pretty unlikely that it would be passed in the House. House Republicans have said that they want an extension to be paid for, and Speaker of the House, John Boehner, has indicated he's not likely to take it up. So basically, if you have been unemployed for more than 6 months in the country right now, it's very unlikely that you're going to see your benefits come back anytime soon.
That is the political wrangling, and there's a very stark reality. What does it mean for those people who rely on this money?
This money is really a lifeline for people. I spoke with people before the benefits were set to expire, and people basically told me that their options would be extremely limited without this support. The support not only helps them to keep looking for a job, to get new job training, to try and get into careers or jobs that will pay them well enough to live, but it also means that they don't have to rely on options like moving in with friends. And I spoke with a couple of people now that the benefits are gone, and it's just clear that they are feeling so incredibly frustrated with Congress and very, very angry. I spoke with one man, Peter LeClaire,
who said he's been a lifelong Republican, but he vowed many times that he is not going to vote Republican any longer because he's seen his Republican congresspeople blocking the benefits he was relying on. He basically said those benefits were keeping him glued together financially. And, you know, there's been this talk on the right that these benefits create a culture of dependency, or that people who rely on them are lazier or not working hard enough to find a job. And everyone felt very insulted by this. You know, LeClaire said basically, how dare you call me lazy? You don't know who I am. And I've sent out over 2,000 resumes and have been rejected over and over again. And a couple other people had the same thing to say, that they keep sending out resumes and nothing turns up. And we know that there are three people looking for jobs for every job opening in the country. And the long-term unemployed especially face pretty daunting odds. There have been studies that they have a much lower likelihood of being able to get a call for an interview or get a job.
It's a thoroughly depressing picture that you paint, Bryce. And it's not just individuals who are suffering, but the economy as a whole.
Absolutely. What we can expect to see is, if these benefits are not reinstated, it's been estimated that nearly 250,000 jobs will be lost. Because basically, that's money that they're going out and spending in the economy. They're buying food, they're paying rent, they're buying clothes. And that goes back into the economy and helps create growth. And without it, that's a huge loss to our economic output. We've already seen that just 1 week of not having the benefits cost states $400 million. So we can imagine that as this goes on, the pain becomes more and more real.
Bryce Covert talking to FSN's Kate Fisher. Now, led by Kuwait and the United States, several Western and Gulf nations pledged a combined $2.4 billion to help fund United Nations relief efforts in Syria. The news comes on the heels of the UN's request for more than double that amount in response to the worsening humanitarian crisis caused by the Syrian civil war. From New York, Ira Spitzer has more.
United Nations aid efforts in Syria received a boost at a donors' conference in Kuwait, with the nations in attendance promising a combined $2.4 billion of relief money. That brings the UN closer to its goal of raising $6.5 billion by the end of the year to provide medical care, food, water, and shelter to the war-torn country, the largest appeal in UN history. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon said that half of Syria's population, about 9.3 million people, needs aid urgently.
No country, no people should face hardship or calamity for helping Syrians in need. It is vital for this region and our world that the burden is shared. Let us reward the compassion of Syria's neighbors with generosity and solidarity.
Ban first announced the funding goal last month and reiterated it at the conference.
I'm asking for strong international support to meet these massive humanitarian needs. We estimate that we need $6.5 billion this year.
The largest donations will come from Kuwait, who promised $500 million, and the United States, who announced a contribution of $380 million. The U.S. has pledged more than $1.7 billion in aid since the crisis began, the most of any donor. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry was on hand in Kuwait to announce the U.S. donation.
Syria's civil war is all of our concerns. That is why the United States, together with other nations, have stepped up. And I'm proud that the United States is the leading donor of humanitarian aid. It's why I'm also proud to announce today, on President Obama's behalf, a new commitment of an additional $380 million in assistance.
Kerry also called on Syrian President Bashar al-Assad to stop using starvation as a method of war and to allow international aid to reach the areas in need. In addition, Qatar and Saudi Arabia pledged $60 million each. The European Union pledged $225 million and Britain $165 million. These latest developments come as the situation in Syria has worsened and the number of refugees has grown to over 2 million people. The devastating civil war has been going on for almost 3 years. However, another concern is whether the promised aid money will actually make its way into UN coffers. Only about 70% of the $1.5 billion pledged last year has actually materialized. Bonn also said that he hoped that the peace talks set to begin in Switzerland on January 22nd will bring the Syrian government and opposition leaders to the negotiating table. Opposition leaders, however, remain deeply divided on whether to attend. Ira Spitzer, New York.
Central and eastern states of the U.S. were blasted by the polar vortex last week, sending temperatures plunging to their lowest level in 20 years. But across the country in California, the mercury has been reaching record highs. Temperature in San Francisco this week are hovering near 69 degrees Fahrenheit, or 20 degrees Celsius. California, a state rich in agriculture and food production, known as the salad bowl of the US, is headed for an official drought. Earlier, we spoke to our correspondent in San Francisco, Rebecca Bowring, about the water shortage.
Well, there are all kinds of effects of this being felt in many parts of the state, particularly up here in the north. Ski resorts are closed, damaging tourism. There are fears that there are going to be more wildfires after that devastating blaze in Yosemite National Park last year. And water agencies have begun a new campaign to urge people to conserve their water. At the moment, we understand that state water reserves are at just 20% of their normal levels. There was a recent snowpack survey in the Sierra Nevada mountains that showed that. And Mendocino County, north of San Francisco, has less than 90 days of water left. They've actually declared a state of emergency there.
California Governor Jerry Brown, he looks set to declare a statewide drought.
Yes, it does look imminent. It could be as soon as the 1st of February. And there are concerns that, that there could be food shortages as a result of this drought in other parts of the U.S. because almost half of the fruit and vegetables and nuts found on American dinner tables come from California. So if harvests are smaller because farmers have had to keep thousands of acres of fields fallow, and because they've been hampered by restrictions on pumping water because of endangered species, then we could see supplies of these goods fall and prices rise, and there being a dependence on imports. This is actually our third consecutive year of drought.
And has there been any explanation on why California is in the grip of such unseasonably hot weather?
Yes, one researcher called it the ridiculously resilient ridge, and it's a zone of high pressure that's come in off the west coast. It's nearly 4 miles high, and it's been stuck there for about 13 months now. And instead of winter storms coming in off the Pacific bringing rain, they're being kind of bounced back and sent up to Alaska or to the east coast of the U.S., which is why there's been a lot of cold and rainy weather across there. Now, some researchers are blaming climate change, but nobody really knows why this high-pressure ridge has been so persistent. 2012 was the driest year on record for most Californian cities, and those records go back 160 years. And worryingly, it's forecast to continue.
And lastly, what are officials actually trying to do in terms of tackling the problem?
Well, Governor Jerry Brown has formed a drought task force, and he's under pressure from a lot of water agencies to declare this official drought because it will bring the crisis to the attention of federal officials, and they will accelerate funding for relief programs. And also, it would help to speed up water transfers between local agencies because some cities have got more water than others. They could send it to the areas that mostly need it most. And they could relax water restrictions because environmental laws are quite strict about water quality here. And the other effect of declaring a drought would motivate the public to save water. And some areas already have water restrictions in place. Like you can only water your lawn twice a week. You can't wash the pavement or the sidewalk. And restaurants, for instance, are being told that they can only serve tap water on request. So it's a case of every little helps.
FSN's Rebecca Bowring in San Francisco. In a recent survey by a London-based think tank, it found businesses in Europe, South Africa and the BRICS nations have a genuine intention to reduce their environmental impact. In Britain, meanwhile, the government has set targets to reduce greenhouse gas emissions by up to 80% by 2050. Our UK correspondent Natalie Powell went to find out what technology is available that could help businesses and homes meet these targets.
On the outskirts of northwest London in the UK stands a rather unusual looking building. They call it the Smart Home. Its innovative design is nothing new. Built in 1998 with a diagonal roof which cascades down almost to the floor, made entirely of orange solar panels. But once inside this prototype home, you'll find all of the latest energy-saving gadgets that are on the market, thanks to a recent refurbishment. The Smart Home is situated in an innovation park owned by the BRE Group, who are experts in research and advice for the built environment sector in the UK. And as John O'Brien, the technical manager for BRE's innovation park, explains, there are several prototype homes here, and all aim to reduce emissions.
The aim of our innovation park here is to strive towards low to zero carbon buildings, and this one goes a long way to achieving that. Some of the things are obvious and some of the things are less obvious. The idea is that most of the technology should be hidden away, and a lot of it is now app enabled, and also things like water use and other embodied energy that is not so visible.
And much of that technology is hidden, including sensors that turn lights off when the sun comes out and walls that capture the heat using cutting-edge panels behind them, which are then, as John O'Brien explains, able to communicate with the windows when the room is too hot.
It then drops the heat back into the room. We're then able to provide a bit of purge ventilation through the roof light, which opens automatically, lets the heat out, and you can start the whole process.
And most of the technology in this home can be controlled remotely using an electronic device inside the house and an app on your mobile phone, meaning that if you're not at home, you can still turn appliances like the washing machine or television off, and that'll help save you some money. Reducing costs and lowering carbon footprints are especially interesting to businesses and governments. CDP is a London-based think tank and international not-for-profit organisation which works with investors, companies and governments to try to drive sustainable economies. In a recent report, they found a large improvement from businesses, particularly from the BRICS countries and Europe, in measuring, managing and reducing their environmental impacts. And Sue Howells, the co-chief operating officer at CDP, says that there are real advantages to businesses who can achieve this.
Through our work with investors and working with the companies, we are really looking to drive sustainable economies. So we are looking at companies taking concrete actions to reduce their environmental impacts, i.e. we're looking at how we can tackle the challenge that we have with climate change. And we see this is not companies just doing it for the sake of doing it. There are benefits to the companies, such as we see those companies in our leadership indices having superior financial performance, for example. We also see companies that are investing in emissions reduction activities. They're seeing a very clear payback on those investments, normally less than 3 years. So we see there are very strong reasons why companies should be doing this.
So this could mean that much of the technology on show in the smart home may be rolled out globally, not only in houses, but also in offices in the near future. Natalie Powell, London.
And that's the Wednesday edition of FSN Reports. You can tell us what you think of our programme by emailing us at reports@featurestory.com. You can also follow us on Twitter. We're there at Feature Story. Coming up on Thursday, FSN Reports brings you all the details as President Obama prepares to announce his NSA reforms. That's Thursday, but for now, I'm Kevin McAleese in Washington, alongside producer Kate Fisher and Rebecca Foster on the Bulletin Desk. For everyone with Feature Story News everywhere, have a great evening. Goodbye.